From Cherokee to Currituck, from the largest city to the smallest town, and from the state house to the schoolhouse, it's Carolina Journal Radio, your weekly news magazine discussing North Carolina's most important public policy events and issues.
Welcome to Carolina Journal Radio. I'm Mitch Kokai. During the next hour, Donna Martinez and I will explore some major issues affecting our state. North Carolina lawmakers still debate whether and how to use targeted tax incentives for economic development. You'll hear highlights from a recent State House committee debate on the topic. A political tug of war between the state school superintendent and the State Board of Education heads to court. You'll hear key elements from both sides of the case. Growing urban areas often face public transportation challenges. We'll chat with a Duke professor who hopes to apply lessons learned from the past to help the Triangle address its current public transit needs. And we'll explore competing proposals to bring a Major League Soccer team to Charlotte or Raleigh. Those topics are just ahead. First, Donna Martinez joins us with the Carolina Journal headline.
As social media platforms have grown into the powerhouse communication tools they are today, so have the questions about their legal liability for those who use them to incite violence or even incite terrorism. And now a North Carolina-connected legal battle is shining the light on Twitter. John Guzet is the John Locke Foundation's Director of Legal Studies. He's been following the case and writing about it. He joins us now. John, welcome back.
Thanks, Donna.
The case is Kane versus Twitter. Give us the details of that case.
Well, this involves two incidents, and they're well known, I think, probably to all listeners. Back in, I think it was 2015, a cell of the terrorist group called ISIS, the Islamic State, launched a terrorist attack in Paris, a very well-publicized one, in which they killed something like 130 people. One of those victims was an American citizen, and her mother, Beatrice Gonzalez, is one of the plaintiffs in this case. A year later, the same terrorist cell launched another attack, this time in Belgium, and in that one they killed 32 people, and one of those was the husband of a North Carolina native, a lady named Ann Cameron Kane. Her father is known possibly to some listeners, Jim Kane. He was, for a while, I think he was the president of the Carolina Hurricanes. He's a well-known Raleigh attorney, and he was even, for some period of time, our ambassador to Denmark.
John, what is the basis of the lawsuit that has been filed against Twitter?
There's a law in the United States, the Anti-Terrorism Act, which makes it a crime to provide material assistance to terrorists, and it also provides a mechanism whereby American citizens can sue any individual organization that provides that kind of assistance to terrorists. So Cameron Kane and Beatrice Gonzalez are suing Twitter because they say, and they provide quite a bit of evidence, that Twitter allowed ISIS to use Twitter as a recruiting tool, and they also say that ISIS terrorists have used Twitter to coordinate their activities, to inspire their various acts of terrorism and so on. So they say this constitutes a form of material assistance to an act of terrorism, and under that, on that basis, they're suing.
John, do we have any sense of either legal precedent or perhaps rulings in this general social media arena that would give us any sort of insight as to whether or not the plaintiffs could prevail against Twitter?
Well, we do, and it's not good news for the plaintiffs in Kane v. Twitter, because in the U.S. District Court for the Northern District of California, a different group of plaintiffs sued Twitter on substantially the same argument. They were some relatives of U.S. contractors who were killed during an ISIS attack in Jordan, and they sued Twitter making many of the same arguments, the gist of which was that Twitter provided material assistance to ISIS by allowing them to use it as a platform for recruitment and so on. When that happened in that case, Twitter filed a motion to dismiss under a different federal law, the Communications Decency Act, which provides it blocks the ability of citizens to sue platforms, communications platforms like Twitter for the content posted by their users. And under that law, Twitter said, we're not liable. And the district court agreed and they dismissed that case. So that's not a good precedent for this, for the plaintiffs in Kane v. Twitter. And in making matters worse, although the case was originally filed in the U.S. District Court for the Southern District of New York, Twitter filed a motion to transfer to the Northern District of California, which is where the previous case was heard, and that was granted. So it's going to be the same court looking at this case as the one that has already dismissed a similar case.
John, you write some interesting things in your piece on this, which is available, of course, at johnlock.org. And you said, look, you know, when I use social media, they're able to figure out ads that are targeted to me. They can keep track of everywhere I've been on the internet, Facebook, Twitter, other things like this. So is it reasonable for us to expect that Twitter, in this case, would be able to somehow screen out people who are terrorists?
Well, I'm certainly not an expert on this kind of thing. In fact, I've never used Twitter on my own behalf. I've only looked at a tweet once or twice in my life. But as I said in the article, I mean, it's clear that they are scanning and monitoring everything we do on all these media platforms. And not only that, they used to take the position that we're all for free speech, free expression. We're not going to do any censorship. I quoted one of the Twitter executives in my piece saying, when you're providing a free expression platform for hundreds of millions of people, you have to take the good with the bad. And he also said something along the lines of one man's terrorist is another man's freedom fighter. But they've changed their tune on this quite a bit. And they really have had to, because they have taken it upon – on their own behalf, they've taken it upon themselves to censor anything they consider politically incorrect. We've seen many incidents of that over the last few years. And it would be pretty hypocritical to say we're going to ban people for saying – things that hurt people's feelings or that feminists don't like, but we're still going to let people recruit terrorists and plan their terrorist operations using our platform. So it does seem as if they can. And let me just add one other thing. They've started boasting about the fact that they're taking down terrorist accounts. They're blocking accounts by people they know to be terrorists, so they can do it. Whether they could do more than they're doing at this point, I really can't say, but it certainly seems reasonable to think they might be able to.
And it's a pretty serious question, really. I mean, where is the legal line between protecting free speech, which in this country is fundamental to who we are, and speech that incites violence?
Well, you know, it's sometimes it's hard to draw the line, but I don't think it's hard to draw the line in this case, because terrorist acts, they're not just illegal under the Anti-Terrorism Act. They're just – it's murder. You can't conspire to commit murder. And if you can show that the ISIS, for example, was using their speech on Twitter to do that, that's a crime. The real issue here isn't whether some speech is legal or not. This speech is definitely illegal. The only question is whether Twitter can and should do something to block it. That's the legal issue that the courts will get to, if that is to say – the whole case isn't simply dismissed over the Communications Decency Act.
In fact, what comes next in this case?
Well, that motion has been filed, and arguments are being heard, I think, just about now. We'll probably know in the next few months what the court will do with it. If they dismiss it, of course, Ann Cameron and Beatriz Gonzalez can appeal, and it's not clear that the district court that's hearing the case and heard the previous case has gotten that right. So they may win on appeal, but there's still a lot of things that they'll have to overcome to win in the long run.
And John, I know that this is not a singular piece that you have written on this general topic. You've actually been doing a series on new media and new laws and this question of how the law catches up with technology.
It's very interesting. But, you know, up until now, it's kind of been just something of academic interest, and sometimes it's amusing. But in this case, there's nothing funny about it. What this looking into this and writing about it brought home to me is we take terrorism for granted a lot now. But when it happens to involve somebody locally, somebody that we know personally or know something about, it reminds us that there's been thousands of victims of terrorism since 9/11. Every one of them has got family members like Cameron Kane and Beatriz Gonzalez. It's a it continues to be a serious problem, and everybody, including social media, is going to have to figure out what to do about it.
John Guzet, the John Locke Foundation's Director of Legal Studies. You can read all of his work at johnlocke.org. John, thanks very much.
Thank you, Donna.
Stay with us. Much more Carolina Journal Radio to come in just a moment.
Government plays a key role in your life, affecting your paycheck, the way you educate your kids, the way you do business. How can you tell if government is doing a good job, making the right choices, spending tax dollars wisely? CarolinaJournal.com tackles those questions every day. The John Locke Foundation publishes Carolina Journal in print each month and on the web each day at CarolinaJournal.com. You'll find exclusive investigative reports on topics no one else is covering. What else? A rundown of the best news stories, editorials, and opinion columns in North Carolina. John Hood's Daily Journal. News stories and important public events at CarolinaJournal.tv. And the voices of the newsmakers themselves at Carolina Journal Radio. In print, on the air, and on the web, you can find the information you need at CarolinaJournal.com. Welcome back to Carolina Journal Radio. I'm Mitch Kokai. State legislators continue their long-running debate about the use of economic development incentives. Republican State Representative Susan Martin recently brought the topic before her colleagues.
North Carolina has one of the largest economies in the world. We're 24th in the world, so it takes 50,000 jobs to decrease unemployment by 1%. Incentives, which we're talking about today, are not going to resolve that issue for us or grow our economy. They're not the answer. Good, sound policy is needed, and I'm proud of the work that we've done in recent years. We have a top-rated business climate, very competitive tax climate. The legal and regulatory environment has improved. We're investing in a skilled workforce, infrastructure for our growing state, and organic growth and the free market will play the largest part in us growing our economy. Many of us are not enthusiastic about incentives in theory. In practice, however, they are a current reality of competing globally and nationally.
That's why Martin has been pushing new incentives legislation. It's designed to steer more state incentives toward smaller, poorer counties, dubbed Tier 1 counties by state government. The idea raised questions. Democrat Kelly Alexander represents part of Mecklenburg County, a larger, wealthier, so-called Tier 3 county.
You have within the Tier 3 areas, inner city components that, for instance, have median incomes below county averages, higher incidence of poverty, some educational challenges, you know, that kind of parallel the criteria that you're using in your Tier 1s. And in reviewing the summary here, I didn't see anything specifically that would benefit those impacted areas within Tier 3s. And I think we missed the boat if we don't include something in there. I mean, for instance, the utility fund. Some of these areas are suffering from aging infrastructure. And because of that could benefit from funding through the utility fund, you know, to help develop some job sites.
Republican John Zoka of Cumberland County brought up a common issue in the incentives debate.
Whenever you talk about the tier system, it's kind of like the third rail. When you touch it, you're in danger of being electrocuted because sometimes the tier changes and you're happy. Sometimes your tier changes for your county, goes down, and you're unhappy. I think we all need to recognize that the tier system is very complex. It's an imperfect system, and somebody's always going to be unhappy with whatever changes, if any, will be made. I mean, I don't think there's anybody in complete agreement with the tier system and where counties are ranked right now. So recognizing that, I think that we as legislators need to balance the overall good that this bill and this approach will do the state as opposed to what imperfections are in it and how it might affect us locally.
Democrat Ken Goodman contends larger, wealthier counties have more resources to address their own needs.
These counties like Wake and Mecklenburg reap most of the benefits from
these programs already, and it seems to me that they, the counties themselves, have some responsibility to develop these high poverty areas, and that they can direct some of that economic development on their own, that it would be easier for them to do that and use some of the benefits that they receive to look after their own low income and high poverty areas. And it is something that needs to be addressed, but I think these counties, these Tier 3 counties, have some responsibility there as well.
Republican Scott Stone represents one of the wealthiest legislative districts in Charlotte, but he says that district has its own economic development challenges.
If you look at my district, which is Ballantyne, we are right next door to what would be the equivalent of a Tier 1 in South Carolina, and they get a lot of opportunity and a lot of investments in Lancaster County, South Carolina, because they are right next door to South Charlotte. And if you didn't have certain retention policies in place and retention incentives, or you will see more and more, and you've already seen it, you see people border hopping just to get the incentive and get the benefit, and those jobs go there, but those folks are still, they're still driving through South Charlotte, and they're still using our infrastructure. They're still, frankly, costing money for the people in Mecklenburg County, but we aren't getting the benefit of having those jobs in Mecklenburg County. So I think the retention part is important, and I've heard that directly from some of the executives of some of the big companies.
Stone's comments prompted a response from Nash County Republican Jeff Collins.
He did point out a real danger and a reason why we want to continue down a path of tax reform and regulatory reform rather than incentives to draw businesses here, because now businesses that have been here a long time and are important to us have realized that we're giving away money to people who are jumping over here across the border on our side from the other side and are now saying, what about me? And it sounds to me, if we continue down the incentive path, we're going to have to start offering incentives to keep jobs rather than just get new jobs, which is why, again, and I think your bill starts to move us in that direction, but we need to get less and less and less dependent on incentives, more and more and more dependent on our tax and regulatory policy and our general business climate in order to get businesses to come here.
Republican Bill Brawley questioned the idea of reducing incentives options in the wealthiest Tier 3 counties.
Would that 800 job opportunity not be comparing a Tier 3 in North Carolina to a Tier 1 in North Carolina, but a Tier 3 in North Carolina to a Tier 3 in Georgia? And is that where you lose the job? Do we end up losing opportunities?
Brawley raised a larger issue, starting with a description of Charlotte's built-in economic advantages.
You've got an airport with 800 daily flights in Mecklenburg County. If you're close to that airport, you've got access to travel. Second to that, Raleigh-Durham, Piedmont Triad, a little further down. With all the hopes for Global Trans Park, if you're in Kinston, you're going to have to go somewhere else to get most of those flights. You've got better rail. You've got better roads. Then you got this cultural thing. Now, there's a lot of art stuff in Mecklenburg County that I used to wonder, why do we keep talking about it? And then I realized that a lot of the people with the corporations that are coming in care a lot about it. My opinion of that does not matter. If that's what they want, that's what they want, and they're going to go where they can get it and not go where they can't. So I think one of the things we keep leaving out of this is the question, how do you sell a Tier 1 area? And the bait of an incentive is not enough. We need what we used to call in the sales game hunters, people that are cold calling, people that are prospecting, people that are identifying what are the attributes of a Tier 1 county, to what type of businesses will those attributes appeal, and go after those companies and recruit them to North Carolina.
Jeff Collins, the Nash County Republican, asked colleagues to look beyond incentives.
We need to really start thinking way outside the box. Our county boundaries are based on populations in the 1500s and 1600s in a lot of cases, especially in eastern North Carolina, and we're going to have these problems as long as we have the same 100 counties we've got and are trying to duplicate the services 100 times in some areas where you got 1 million people and some areas where you got 10,000 people. It doesn't make any sense, and we need to blur. If we don't change the counties and don't change them from 100 to 25 or 40 or whatever makes sense, we at least need to blur the county lines when we're talking about services.
You've been listening to highlights from a recent debate about targeted tax incentives in North Carolina. We'll return with more Carolina Journal Radio in a moment.
Are you looking to make North Carolina more free? The John Locke Foundation is, and here are 3 things you can do today to help us make it happen. First, know the facts. Visit johnlocke.org for data, analysis, interviews, and more. And read carolinajournal.com to learn what government is doing with your money. Second, influence the debate. Invest in the John Locke Foundation's work with a tax-deductible donation. You can get it done in less than 90 seconds at johnlocke.org. And third, make North Carolina more free by sharing the message of freedom. It's easy when you visit johnlocke.org. Click on shareables, download, pass the messages of freedom to your friends, print the messages and mail them. Or if you're a savvy computer user, share the message of freedom on Facebook and Twitter. Know the facts, influence the debate, and share the message. 3 things you can do today to help us make North Carolina more free. Get started today at johnlocke.org.
North Carolina is changing, not just day to day, but hour to hour, minute to minute, even second to second. How can you keep up with the changes, especially the ones that affect you, your family, your home, your job? Make the John Locke Foundation and Carolina Journal part of your social media diet. On Facebook, like the John Locke Foundation, like Carolina Journal. Follow us on Twitter, at John Locke NC and at Carolina Journal. News, insights, and analysis you'll find nowhere else. Thanks to the experts at the John Locke Foundation, and thanks to the first-class investigative reporting of Carolina Journal. Don't wait for the morning newspaper. Don't wait for the evening news. If it's happening now, it's happening here. The John Locke Foundation and Carolina Journal have you covered with up-to-the-second information. Like us on Facebook, the John Locke Foundation and Carolina Journal. Follow us on Twitter, at John Locke NC and at Carolina Journal.
Did you know you can now advance freedom and free markets just by shopping with Amazon? It's true. Online shopping is now a great way to support the John Locke Foundation. Just shop using the Amazon Smile program and designate us, the Locke Foundation, to receive a portion of your purchase amount. That's right. You shop and Amazon donates money to us, the John Locke Foundation. So here's how it works. Log on to smile.amazon.com. Amazon Smile, it's the same Amazon you know. Same products, same prices. But here's what's better. Amazon donates 0.5% of the price of your eligible purchases to us, the John Locke Foundation. So try it. Be sure to designate the Locke Foundation as the nonprofit you want to support. It's that easy. So now, not only will you enjoy what you buy, you'll also support freedom. Don't forget, log on to smile.amazon.com today, buy something nice, and help defend freedom. Help support the John Locke Foundation.
Welcome back to Carolina Journal Radio. I'm Mitch Kokai. A power struggle over North Carolina's public schools has headed to court. On one side, the appointed State Board of Education. On the other side, the elected Superintendent of Public Instruction. They've been feuding about a new state law that shifts some power away from the appointed board and toward the elected superintendent. Former State Supreme Court Justice Bob Orr represents the Board of Education. He says history is on the board's side.
Nearly 150 years. We celebrate the 150th anniversary of the 1868 Constitution next year. The basic constitutional structure for the governance, growth, and administration of the public school system has been in place. The State Board has the express constitutional power to administer and supervise the public education system and the finances appropriated for it, and to make rules and regulations for the system. The legislation at issue in this case attempts to undo this 149-year history of defined constitutional responsibilities and should be declared unconstitutional.
Or specifically opposes the new state law.
This legislation, without question, attempts to take specifically designated constitutional powers to administer and supervise the public school system and its finances, and attempts by statute to transfer those constitutional powers to the superintendent in his official capacity.
On the other side, Attorney Hardy Lewis represents the state superintendent. He says the 150-year-old state constitution tells a different story.
I think that the word that I would use to describe what the framers intended is flexibility. And I think it is easy to see this in both the way that the Constitution was written in 1868 and in the way it's evolved. In 1868, the Constitution had this proviso at the end of the authorizing provision for the State Board. It said, "But all acts, rules, and regulations of said board may be altered, amended, or repealed by the General Assembly. And when so altered, amended, or repealed, they shall not be reenacted by the board." There is no question but that the intent of the framers and the intent of the people in 1868 was to make the General Assembly the supreme authority in setting the policy for the education of our children in the public schools in North Carolina. There can be no question about that.
You've heard opposing legal arguments put forward during a recent court fight. It pits the state superintendent of public instruction against the State Board of Education. At issue, who has the power to set and carry out state education policy? We'll return with more Carolina Journal Radio in a moment.
Are you tired of fake news? Well, you won't find it here. At Carolina Journal, we don't make things up and we don't presume or assign motives. There's no simpler way to put it than that. We're proud to say that honest, factual, rigorous journalism is the Carolina Journal way. Our reporting team is focused on accountability in government and policymaking, no matter which political party is in power and regardless of the person taken to task in the story. At Carolina Journal, we're beholden to the truth and to transparency. Unlike fake news, lies, innuendo, questionable sourcing, all meant to create controversy, not inform the debate. So the next time you're confronted with fake news, log on to CarolinaJournal.com or pick up the latest print edition. You'll find compelling news reporting from a team that knows what it means to be real journalists, committed to truth. Carolina Journal, you can count on us for the facts.
Welcome back to Carolina Journal Radio. I'm Mitch Kokai. Urban growth has its costs along with its benefits. Among its impacts, more traffic. It's a situation the Triangle will be forced to address. Well, our next guest has focused recently on how other communities have handled this topic. John Stadden is an emeritus professor at Duke University. Welcome back to the program.
Hi, Mitch.
This is something that obviously we who have to travel on I-40 or I-85 in the Triangle are noticing, that there's more and more traffic and we're growing and growing and are probably likely to see even more of this. So that prompted you to take a step back and say, well, how has everyone else addressed this problem, right?
Well, sort of. I think I had a traumatic experience for which I should have sought psychological guidance, namely driving in Atlanta, which was an extraordinary thing to me. I mean, you simply can't move the whole town place. I complained to my friends there, and they said, "Is this Russia?" "Oh, no, it's not the Russia. That's all the time," they said. So obviously, when you have a city designed like Atlanta or Washington, D.C., and so on, this kind of thing is inevitable. And so the question is, what do you do about it? But the first thing is to recognize the problem. I think the first thing is to really recognize we are going to have gridlock if we don't do anything at all.
And so you're saying the first step, I guess, like the first step of the alcoholic, recognize you have a problem and then move up. So if we have a problem or an emerging problem with traffic in the Triangle, what do you think we need to do?
Well, the first thing is obviously to recognize it. But then the paths out of it are really not all that clear. I mean, the standard solution is some kind of rail. All the big cities in Europe, which of course are old, to some extent New York, but mostly in Europe, they all have light rail systems. But all of those systems were started at a time when there was no competition. So the London Underground, which I'm going to talk about a little bit, the London Underground was started when the only option was horse-drawn travel through very crowded streets of London. So obviously it was a great business opportunity. It was started by private enterprise, funded privately. They didn't have to deal with underground cables and pipes and things like that the way they do now. So that made business sense. Now, however, it's not so clear. It's not so clear. There are technical possibilities, Uber and Lyft and so on. Maybe we can advance a little bit with that, but nobody really knows. The thing about the rail possibility, which is the issue in the triangle, the thing about the rail possibility is if you're going to do it, now's the time to do it. That's the point. It's going to be cheaper now than it will be later. There's a lot of talk, I don't know if it's much more than that, about the importance of infrastructure. So there are reasons to do it. If you're going to do it now. On the other hand, maybe we should just wait and seize up like Atlanta, or maybe have flying cars. Who knows?
We are speaking with John Stadden. Dr. John Stadden is an emeritus professor at Duke University. This is one of those cases which, for those who are frequent listeners to this program, they've heard you on this show before. And sometimes you put forward a view that it may be a little bit outside the mainstream, like talking about smoking and public health costs, or how we deal with traffic signals and that sort of thing. When you took a look at this issue, did you say to yourself, hey, everyone is talking about transit in these terms when they should be looking at it this way? Did you take a look at it and say people were addressing it the wrong way?
Well, I'd like to say that I had an enormous insight based on my vast experiences. But I have to say, the more I looked into it, the more complicated it seemed to me. It really, I think, depends on the will of the people, in a sense. If everybody feels, well, the triangle's one unit, we really ought to have an integrated system, we're willing to sign off on the necessary money to get started and so on, then it'll probably work. But if they don't feel that way, it's not going to work. I mean, I'll talk a little bit about the Durham Chapel Hill system, which is a tiny little transit beginning. It doesn't connect with the airport, which seems like one of the obvious places it should connect to because of the cost and so on. So maybe it'll just go from step to step like that, and everybody will wake up 10 years from now in a massive gridlock and say, well, you know, maybe we should have done something. Or maybe they won't. You know, maybe some other solution. Maybe everybody will go to downtown Durham and Chapel Hill and live in apartments. I mean, who knows? I don't really know. So I guess my simple answer is it's not simple. It's very complicated.
One of the other things that you referenced that I'd like to turn back to is we've seen in recent years the development of things like Uber, Lyft. There's also this discussion of introducing, to a greater extent, driverless cars, which would offer another example.
We already have brainless politicians. Why not?
Yes, that's right. That's right. So if brainless politicians are possible, driverless cars. With all of those options on the table, do you think there will be enough support for adopting what is this basically 19th century technology, or will more people say, well, let's just sit back and see what else happens?
Well, that's going to be very interesting. I mean, that's what I see as the current tension. The problem is that the cost and ease of doing light rail gets – the cost goes up and it gets more and more difficult with time. So in a sense, we're taking a bit of a gamble. Maybe – a lot of people will feel, well, we believe in driverless cars or Uber or computerized ride sharing or something of this sort, although there are problems with that. I mean, Uber substitutes a private car for a public car, basically for your own personal car, but it's still one person per car. That's not going to really change any kind of congestion and so on. Maybe some clever computerized system will reduce. It's not going to eliminate. Will reduce the number of journeys per day, but it's by no means serious. So you're taking a chance on that branch. Okay, the other branch, well, it's going to be expensive up front. I mean, there's no question that light rail is going to be expensive, and it won't make money at first, you know, because of competition from cars. But as congestion gets worse, people will be driven into the mass transit. And that's already happened in some places like Seattle, I understand.
Now, one of the other things that's cropped up in the debate here in the Triangle is some people saying, okay, maybe we should get more public transit, but why does it have to be trains? Why can't we get a better bus system that more people will want to use? Have you been thinking about that
at all? Yeah, I mean, yeah, that's a very good question. Buses are in some ways more flexible and in some ways less flexible. They're more flexible, you can change routes and so on. But the very fact that they're not as predictable over the long term as a rail means that they won't act as a guide to residential location and so on the way that a rail system does. And they are, I suppose, more subject to weather and that kind of thing. I don't know that there is any city, and again, this is something people should spend more time studying. I don't know that it's any city which has really solved its transit problems solely by the aid of buses. Light rail, by maintaining a restricted path that only the rail train could go on and so on, seems to have some advantages, particularly for distance travel. If you want to have go a reasonable distance, in other words, stops more than a quarter mile apart or something, obviously a light rail can do it in a way that a bus can't. So that's one difference.
We have very short time remaining, but if you had to put on your prediction hat, do you think the Triangle will end up with some sort of rail system in the not-too-distant future?
Yeah, I mean, I think the Durham-Chapel Hill thing probably will go ahead. People in those communities seem to be in favor of it. Whether it will extend, I mean, there's very poor integration of the Triangle as a whole, as many of you probably know.
One person who's going to be watching this issue very closely is our guest, John Statton. He's an emeritus professor at Duke University. Thanks so much for joining us.
Well, thanks, Mitch.
We'll have more on Carolina Journal Radio in just a moment.
If you love freedom, we've got great news to share with you. Now you can find the latest news, views, and research from conservative groups all across the state, all in one place. NorthCarolinaConservative.com, one-stop shopping for North Carolina's freedom movement. At NorthCarolinaConservative.com, you'll find links to John Locke Foundation blogs on the day's news, CarolinaJournal.com reporting and quick takes, Carolina Journal radio interviews, TV interviews featuring CJ reporters and Locke Foundation analysts, plus opinion pieces and reports on higher education, all of that from the Pope Center for Higher Education Policy, commentary and polling data from the Civitas Institute, and news and views from the North Carolina Family Policy Council. That's right, all of that, all in one place. NorthCarolinaConservative.com. That's North Carolina, spelled out, conservative.com. NorthCarolinaConservative.com. Log on today. Welcome back to Carolina Journal Radio. I'm Donna Martinez. Well, every major city wants a professional sports franchise, or two, or even three. And now Charlotte and Raleigh are making bids for a Major League Soccer team. Now, last week, the head of the MLS visited North Carolina to explore the details of these two competing bids. One of those folks who's following the effort is the John Locke Foundation's Julie Tisdale. She follows city and county government for the Locke Foundation. She's been taking a look at both of these bids and is here to give us the details. Julie, welcome back.
Thanks, Donna.
First of all, give us a sense of the key players in these two competing bids.
Okay, so we've got two bids. One is in Charlotte. The key person there is Marcus Smith. He's the son of Bruton Smith of NASCAR fame.
Yeah.
They own several racetracks around the country. Very wealthy Charlotte family and very well established in this sports entertainment business. On the in Raleigh, we've got Steve Malik, who is the owner of the Carolina was the Carolina RailHawks, now North Carolina FC. So a lot of experience here in Raleigh with soccer, sort of one level below Major League Soccer.
What is it specifically that you're focusing on as you follow these bids?
Well, there have been 12 bids across the country, and Major League Soccer is going to choose two initially and then a further two. Two of those bids here are in North Carolina, in Charlotte and Raleigh. And what I'm looking at is the financing of the stadium. In both cases, most of the other fees for joining and that sort of thing will be handled by the ownership groups. But the key difference is how they're going to build a stadium. Major League Soccer insists that you have a soccer-specific stadium. So in both cases, we're talking about new construction, a stadium that would seat about 20, 22,000 people. In Charlotte, Marcus Smith came forward with this proposal that he would pay for half and then asked the city and the county to each take a quarter. Those numbers, it was about $175 million for the stadium overall. He said he'll do $87.5 million, and then asking each of the county and the city to do $43.75 million.
So far, do we know how the city or the county is responding to that request?
We do. It's a little bit of a complex picture. The county initially got behind this, supported it, voted, approved this whole scheme, which is the 43.75. In addition to that, the county voted to loan $75 million to Marcus Smith to be part of his $87.5 million that he would pay. So $75 million loan that would be repaid over 25 years. So that's all the county. They voted for that. The city council said, we're not there yet. We're not really even ready to vote on this. And so they shut it down. This was back in February, I think, maybe a little later than that. No, that was January. Anyway, the city sort of said no. The city has now said, well, maybe we could do as much as 30. The county is also saying, well, if the city's not in, then we're not sure we are. So it's a little bit of a mess in Charlotte right now. And so there are a lot of moving parts still. But that's how things stand at the moment.
It sounds like there is a lot of taxpayer involvement in the
Charlotte
bid. There's
a lot of taxpayer involvement, yeah. Any way you slice this, we're talking about at least half coming from the taxpayers. And then on top of that half coming from directly from the taxpayers, we've got an addition of this loan that the taxpayers of Mecklenburg County would be making to the Smiths. So it is a lot of taxpayer money in that bid.
Okay, so that's what Charlotte is looking like,
yes.
That proposal. Now let's turn to the Raleigh package. Steve Malik at the head of that bid. Tell us about it.
We know a lot less about what's happening in Raleigh. And the reason we know a lot less is that from the beginning, Steve Malik has said this is going to be a privately funded venture. Well, if it's privately funded, he doesn't have to reveal any of those details, and it doesn't have to be voted on. So we don't have nearly as much information. What we do know is that he's planning to build a stadium that would cost about $150 million, possibly some cost overruns that he's planning for. So about $150 million. And he's planning to build that himself and finance that with his own personal assets and then with development partners. However, when MLS came to visit, we learned a little bit more detail, and we learned that we learned a little bit more detail, which included that Malik's looking for some land that's currently owned by the state to be the site for this stadium. Now, that raises a lot of questions. Would it be gifted? Is he going to buy it? Is there some sort of lease agreement? What's going on with that land? So previously, we thought we had a privately financed bid. Now we've got a mostly private, but with a substantial chunk that's going to be public contribution of some sort. So we're still looking for some details there.
Do we know yet, Julie, that land that is owned by the state mm-hmm. that Mr. Malik would like to
right.
place that stadium on, do we have any sort of numbers on it? Do we know what it's valued at? It seems to me like that would give us a good sense of how in taxpayers are on this whole thing.
Right. We don't know, or at least I don't know. I haven't read that figure anywhere. We are talking about 13 acres in downtown Raleigh.
That's so prime real estate.
It's valuable property. That said, at the moment, there's not a whole lot on it. There are some state government buildings. There's a big parking lot. So it certainly could be put to better, more productive use. But yeah, we don't have the numbers for the exact value of that property yet.
Julie, why are you so concerned about taxpayers being involved? Because I can tell you what you hear from supporters of these major league franchises in these stadiums all across the country, not just here in North mm-hmm. Carolina. They say, look, this is a quality of life issue. This is going to attract tourism. There's going to be economic development that follows the stadium. And if a state or a local government is involved, well, it's worth it in the end. That's their argument.
That is the argument. You hear that a lot. If you look at the research about the actual economic impact that comes from having a major league sports franchise, it's pretty minimal. There's not much evidence that it actually has any impact at all, positive or negative. There might be a slight negative impact, actually, but it's pretty neutral. And the reason for that is that this doesn't bring new dollars to Raleigh. I and you and most people, I think, have pretty fixed recreation and entertainment budgets. And so I can spend those going to the movies or going bowling or going out to a local restaurant, or I can go buy tickets to a soccer game, but I can't do both. So most of the money that's going to be most of the sort of spending that's going to happen in association with this stadium is already happening just somewhere else locally.
It's just a shift in how someone would spend their dollars.
It's a shift. So is it fun to have a team? Sure. There might be some quality of life things going on there. But when we look at the economic impact, it's really not very significant for cities.
Well, the next question then I think our listeners are probably thinking is, well, is it even possible to do a stadium without some sort of public involvement?
It is possible and is extremely, extremely rare. The truth is the examples that we most often give about publicly or privately funded stadiums still have some small bit of public input, either a land contribution or they're doing some infrastructure development or that sort of thing. That usually happens. It is possible, and there are a few examples, particularly with minor league stadiums that have been done completely privately. But we have done so much of it now that owners groups have come to expect it.
And so what does this mean now, particularly for the folks in Charlotte, where there seem to be even bigger questions about the public involvement in this and taxpayer funds being at risk, et cetera, than in Raleigh? What can someone do? Do they need to contact their local officials if they want to weigh in on any of this?
Contacting local officials is great. Certainly any sort of sale of land would require a vote. In the case of Raleigh, you're talking about state land, so that's probably the General Assembly. In Charlotte, it is city and county government, so contacting those people is fantastic. The other thing, though, is that this is really in the hands of Major League Soccer at this point. They're touring the country. They're looking at 12 different bids, and they'll be making a choice later in the year.
Do we have any sense as to whether it's Charlotte or Raleigh, or could it actually be that somewhere across the country, another state gets the franchise?
It's certainly very possible that another state could get the franchise. It's really hard to tell, and MLS isn't revealing very much right now, so we don't know. I think, you know, a North Carolina bid there is some possibility there, but it's just too early to tell.
Julie Tisdale has been following the story for us. Julie, thanks very much.
Thank you.
That's all the time we have for the program this week. Thanks for listening. On behalf of Mitch Kokai, I'm Donna Martinez. Hope you'll join us again next week for more Carolina Journal Radio.
Carolina Journal Radio is a program of the John Locke Foundation. To learn more about the John Locke Foundation, including donations that support programs like Carolina Journal Radio, send email to development@johnlocke.org or call 1-866-JLF-INFO. That's 1-866-553-4636.
Carolina Journal Radio is a co-production of the John Locke Foundation, North Carolina's free market think tank, and Carolina Broadcasting System, Incorporated. All opinions expressed on this program are solely those of the participants and do not necessarily reflect the opinions of advertisers or the station. For more information about the show or other programs and services of the John Locke Foundation, visit johnlocke.org or call us toll-free at 866-JLF-INFO. We'd like to thank our wonderful radio affiliates across North Carolina and our sponsors. From all of us at Carolina Journal Radio, thank you for listening, and please join us again next week.